WGN. Hey there, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us. A little bit longer show today. Instead of 12 to 1, we're going to go up to 1:30 when we turn you over to Andy Mazur for that White Sox pregame. Get you all ready for that. But right now, we are joined by Corey Driebusch, who is a reporter at Wall Street Journal, who wrote about Uber's IPO yesterday, which many saw as a pretty weak showing. There was, I think, a lot of speculation that it was going to be a real whopper of a thing. Not so much. Corey, welcome to the program.
Hi, Amy. Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for being with us today on a Saturday. Appreciate you. So talk us through this. I think there was so much speculation leading into this IPO, and then the stock ended up closing a bit lower than it opened with.
Yes. So heading into the IPO of Uber, it's important to think back on what Uber means to the startup community. You think about this is the nation's most valuable startup heading into its IPO. It changed how people think of transportation and think of how many other companies are now called the Uber of blank. So even as recently as last year, there was talk about how Uber was going to be fetching a valuation at its IPO of about $100 billion to $120 billion. In the weeks leading up to the IPO, it ended up kind of ratcheting down that target valuation to about $80 to $90 billion, and it ended up pricing its IPO on Thursday night at the lower end of its range at $45 a share, which gave it a valuation of about just a little over $80 billion, or $82 billion or so. So it was already coming down, and then it started trading. And when it opened on the New York Stock Exchange on Friday, it opened lower than its IPO price, which is never a great sign.
No, not at all. And not necessarily a very common thing, especially for something with this much fanfare around it. I can't help but wonder, though, and I don't want to overstate the significance of this happening, but, you know, here's a company that, as you said, you know, really made a very significant role for itself in the startup world. It disrupted urban transportation and the taxi industry and made us have very public conversations about even workers' rights and the nature of work in a very new way. It made a lot of regulators question, the letter of the law and how it's written. And you know, it held a and still holds a really significant spot. And so, you know, what does that mean that its IPO didn't perform as well as it perhaps could have, and I think as a lot of people intended it for it to, when it holds this much, you know, when the stakes are this high around it?
Yeah, I think that's what a lot of people are grappling with this weekend following Friday's performance. There was a lot of talk heading into its pricing of its IPO, and people we spoke with close to the matter, either close to the underwriters or to the company or to investors, they all agreed that they were pricing the shares lower as a conservative method because of what was kind of going around in the market. Think about, we had our president last weekend tweeting and kind of setting off this an additional firestorm around this potential trade war between the U.S. and China. And then Lyft, another ride-hailing startup, Uber's biggest competitor, one could say, at least in the U.S., their shares went public in late March, and their shares have just sank since then. They're down almost 30%. So there was a lot of kind of, the momentum wasn't on Uber's side this week, to put it mildly. And I don't know how much you can read into Uber's business model and what it means for the disruptors. But one thing that I think an initial takeaway that I'm thinking a lot about is how Uber really skewed the public market for so many years. It was one of those poster child for let's stay private and raise more private money rather than going public. And you can't help but wonder, like, is this going to change that? Maybe it waited too long. Who knows?
I know. I wonder those same things. And I also wonder if maybe this is the beginning of a bit of a shift. I think for a while, tech companies could just do no wrong. And they, you know, they would just had the Midas touch and could just kind of print money. And it seemed so easy for them to succeed and to thrive and to just deal with astronomical amounts of money and do so well. I wonder, and of course, part of that is, you know, as you pointed out, we had a very volatile stock market recently, but also I wonder if we are moving into a little bit different time for tech companies on the stock exchange. You know, I'm thinking as Slack is headed into their IPO and things like that.
Of course, yes. And Slack is one of the biggest tech companies in the coming weeks that we're going to be seeing officially launching their IPOs. But I don't think that they have it's not too terrible for them. Pinterest and another well-known venture-backed video conferencing company, Zoom Video Communications, they hit the public markets in the past couple months, and their shares have just soared since then. I believe Pinterest shares are up more than 50%, and Zoom's have basically tripled since their IPO, or doubled since their IPO price, rather. Zoom obviously has profits, which is something good, and Pinterest is growing really fast, even though it has losses. Uber is definitely has big losses that are concerning to some investors that we spoke with heading into the IPO. Uber, to put it in perspective, Uber's loss in the 12 months through March rose to more than $3.7 billion. And that's by far the largest ever for a U.S. startup in the year before an IPO, according to S&P Global Market Intelligence. So those losses maybe are something investors are less keen to embrace when they're investing in publicly traded companies.
What do you think, if any, do you think that the strike earlier this week from rideshare drivers around the globe, do you think that had any bearing on the result of the IPO?
To be honest, investors we spoke with barely even mentioned the strike. That was not of concern. I think what was much more of concern were these losses, slowing growth in the past month leading up to the IPO, and the performance of Uber's competitor Lyft, and just worries that when will Uber be able to be profitable? Kind of around the two latter points about slowing growth and Lyft's performance. The slowing growth for both companies had to do with this race to going public. Both were going public within a couple months of one another, and they both started, I'm sure anyone who uses Lyft or Uber has probably noticed in the past year, they got a lot more promotions saying 50% off your rides this weekend as they tried to steal market share away from one another. And in Lyft's case, they did steal away quite a bit of market share, but at a price. It cost them money, and it cost Uber money to try to compete.
Indeed, and I've had some conversations with some rideshare drivers, you know, which do you do both? Do you do one or the other?
And
a lot of Lyft drivers have said to me that they, you know, prefer to drive for Lyft, and if this is just me anecdotally speaking to people, but a lot have said, but you know, once in a while Uber runs this special and it really makes it impossible to be away. So I think that's hitting both drivers and consumers, these, you know, increased number of deals. So it's very interesting. It's a very interesting time for ride sharing and that community, and also just the tech world. I think there's some change afoot, hard to really name what it is yet, but I appreciate you being with us today, Corey Driebusch, reporter at Wall Street Journal. Thanks for breaking it all down with us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. All right, we're going to take a little break, and more of this when we get back on the other side of news. We're going to be talking about some allegations against Expedia. You're definitely going to stay around for that. Back in just a bit here on 720 WGN. Seven 820 WGN. It's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today, sharing part of your Saturday. A little bit longer show today. Usually we wrap things up at 1 o'clock and turn things over to Scott Catoon. Today at 1:30, I'll hand you over to Andy Mazur for that White Sox pregame, and he'll get you all ready for that game broadcast. Still lots to do on the show today, though. We were just talking a bit ago with Corey Driebusch, a reporter at Wall Street Journal, about Uber's IPO, and I think... You know, I both don't want to beat a dead horse, and I also am fascinated by this and don't want to stop talking about it. It's one of those stories, right? You know, I can't look away. It's a weird one because I think, I mean, I think there's, you know, for as much as we talk about business as being, it's just business, it's unemotional, it's not, that's nonsense, because there's always a human emotional component to it. You know, we see, even in our, when you look at reporting around Wall Street, it'll say, you know, the Dow did XYZ based on fears of this.
Right.
You know, there's always an emotional component in that, and we don't always acknowledge that. I still think...
And these IPOs for tech companies, which we talk about a lot now, and we talked about it last week with Beyond Meat, which is not a tech company, but sort of is acting like one its IPO. It's all based on conjecture, and it's just all about hopes and fears, because most of them are not profitable. Uber is certainly not profitable. I mean, they make a lot of money, but they, I think, have accrued $8 billion of debt over the course of their existence.
Right.
At the end of last year.
Not insignificant.
And so, look, it's not like you're just looking at the numbers and it's like, oh, that the numbers say it's all good here. I mean, people who know more about this stuff than me have a different way of viewing the sets of numbers that exist for these companies. But basically, you're right. Yeah, it's about... expectations, hopes, and fears.
And, you know, the reporter that we were talking to said she spoke with a lot of investors that said, the strike didn't really matter to me. It's really about this company. I think a couple things. I mean, this is just my, you know, armchair expertise here, right? Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think they waited a little too long for their IPO. It seems like Uber's been around such a long time.
Mm-hmm.
My guess is prior to a lot of scandal hitting the company, they were probably close. And then they figured, we've got these harassment claims. We should let this one kind of sit for a minute.
Ride it out and get rid of Travis Kalanick.
Yeah, right.
And then when it dies down, we'll make our big splash.
Yeah, which I think would be a smart move that most people would, a smart call that most people would make. I also think that, you know, there is a David and Goliath narrative in a lot of things where we kind of sometimes can't look away. We almost need our Goliaths to stumble a little bit.
Right.
In a weird way. I think people kind of delight in this, you know, especially, you know, Uber's had so many stumbles. We saw the worker strike, and although maybe some investors don't feel like that had a lot of bearing, I think a lot of people did feel some sympathy for the drivers and some of the issues with them.
It also kind of felt like a round one. I mean,
absolutely.
I think that will come back with more. I mean, look, what do I know? But that's how it felt to me. Like that, there will be another round of that with more exposure, maybe a little more awareness of not just people using the service, but drivers. You know, but I don't really know what effect that had, and Corey knows more than me. But no, yeah.
Yeah, you know, it's hard for me to imagine that the strike had no bearing on it, and that past foibles that Uber has dealt with, even though it's, you know, leadership has changed and whatnot, I still think that on one hand, social media moves fast and people forget things in a day. On the other hand, sometimes there is a long public memory for big things like that.
Yeah, and just kind of a snowball effect. It just, you know, things start to stick over time. And you might not even remember what the transgression was, but it's just the name rings different to you.
Right.
The truth is that Lyft and Uber, both public companies now, look about the same in their numbers. They're both down roughly in the same space. So who knows what it'll shake out to look like in the future.
Well, and I think now that they're both public and now things are they're on a little more equal footing, you know, the narratives around each aside. they're, you know, just on paper, they appear to be on a little more equal footing. They're both public at this point. It'll be interesting to see how things go now. I predict competition will get a little fiercer between the two.
Sure.
And we'll probably see, you know, as Corey was telling us before the break, a lot more specials, a lot more trying to recruit for one or the other to be a user of either Lyft or Uber and be loyal to one of the brands.
Yeah. And then Uber does really prize their specials, and that's how they drive a lot of business with these deals.
Yeah. And what I understand from drivers is that they're almost irresistible. Like this
right.
bonus, if you do X number of rides, we will give you this extra couple hundred dollars. And I mean, who would say no, right?
Yeah.
That would be very difficult to say no to if that's how you're making your living. So who can blame? So I think it'd be interesting. But we'll keep watching this story, because I think it's a really interesting one. And I think it's, I don't know, I predict that we've just moved into a little more cautious space with our tech companies. I think there's a lot of people are shifting the way they feel about Facebook. Some people have just gotten off Facebook. People are thinking differently about Twitter now. I think people are starting to go, you know what, Silicon Valley, reel it in a little bit. We got things to do. I don't know. That's just kind of my gut feeling there, but we'll see how that plays out indeed. All right, well, we're going to take a break, get you to news, all that good stuff, just in a bit on 720 WGN. WGN. It's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. We're going to keep you updated at the top and bottom of every hour on the weather. It's kind of gloomy looking out there. And a little bit longer show today. We're going to go till 1:30 when we'll turn things over to Andy Mazur for the White Sox pregame. We're joined right now, though, by phone by David McLaughlin, a reporter at Bloomberg, who wrote about Expedia, which is under investigation for allegedly conspiring with hotel chains, to suppress competition from other online travel bookers. David, thanks so much for being with us today. Break this down for us. What's happening with Expedia right now?
Hi, so thanks for having me. This case is about whether hotel companies, the big ones like Marriott and Hilton and Hyatt, basically colluded with one another, so reached agreements with one another with Expedia to prevent one another to not bid on keyword ads that show up on Google. So if you were looking for a hotel in Chicago, like, you know, Marriott, then only the Marriott, the company would bid on those words, and those you'd only see Marriott ads at the top of Google searches. But you would not see, under this agreement, and this is what the case is about, you would not see competing ads from, say, Hilton or Hyatt or Intercontinental, you know, than any of these big chains. And so the claim is that because of all this, people saw fewer competing ads and they had less choice for hotels to pick from.
And so how did this story first begin to surface? What were the dominoes that began to fall for this information to become public?
So this all came up in a lawsuit filed in December by a small startup that was basically what's called a downstream affiliate from Expedia. So it was a company that would try to sell hotel rooms on Google Ads. They claimed that they uncovered this conspiracy and sued to stop it. And then they went to the Utah Attorney General's office, and last week the Utah Attorney General had to go to court because the company that had brought the complaint to them was prohibited due to an arbitration from not complying with the subpoena. So the Utah Attorney General went to court to enforce the subpoena, and in that filing, the state disclosed that they're investigating, and it's not just Utah. They say in their filing that there are actually other states, although they don't disclose which ones, but that there are other states that are also investigating.
And, you know, there's a detail in this story that, for those of you who follow me on Twitter, I've already tweeted the story out so you can read it for yourself. There's a detail I don't know that a lot of people are aware of, and that is that, the sentence says, Expedia, which also owns OrbitzHotels.com and Trivago, I think we think of those as very separate brands and not this one big organization with a lot of tentacles to it.
Right. So it it's called, right, it's like you think you have a lot of choices with these companies, but in reality you don't, because they're all owned by one company. The other the other big company is Booking.com, and they own a bunch of other well-known sites. They're really just those travel sites that we all use. They're really just two big companies. They own tons of brands. And, you know, actually it's like that in a lot of industries. So this is not that unusual, but the choice that we think we might have, really we don't.
Right. And if all these allegations are true, it's even grimmer than that. So what was the most surprising thing to you about this story and reporting it?
Well, what I think this story is about is it gives you a little bit of a look into the Google search, the Google search results that we see every day. And it's a little bit of an inside look into how those results, which we think are sort of free from interference, right, get in front of us. And so if this lawsuit is correct, this means that very large companies were preventing us from seeing all the possible, you know, choices for hotels that we might otherwise think that we would get on Google. And you don't really know that from just using Google. So, no, we haven't heard from the hotel companies. They didn't comment on this story or on this investigation, and neither did Expedia. So it's important to note that, you know, we're really just getting one side of this story. But if it is true, then it's just an interesting look at how, you know, the decisions that companies make and how that influences what we see on Google.
Indeed. It kind of reminds me of a lot of the issues that were being surfaced when we were beginning to have very big conversations about net neutrality. It's certainly, you know, a lot of the same issues there, too. So is it possible, though, that Expedia, these allegations against Expedia are not accurate? And if that is the case, what is the likely scenario of how this accusation could have come to pass?
Of course, it's possible that either the allegations are not true, or more likely, Expedia and the hotels have an argument about why what they're doing, it just isn't illegal. Part of that argument might be that a rival hotel shouldn't be able to bid on a keyword search that doesn't involve its name, so that if you searched Marriott in Chicago, there might be an argument about why Hilton shouldn't be allowed to bid on that name. Although federal regulators have sort of weighed into this issue in a separate case and have said that's not a good argument, and they've rejected that argument. But really, without getting a court ruling on the lawsuit that was filed against Expedia, or actually Expedia is not a defendant, the hotels are a defendant. Without getting a ruling on that case, we don't know whether this is a good case or not. It's certainly possible that the states could investigate these allegations and then decide not to bring a case. But ultimately, if they do find it's a violation of antitrust laws, then they can go to court to find these companies and prevent the conduct from continuing.
Yeah, and it certainly seems like the type of case that has the potential to be very precedent setting with other areas of business and other companies that might be, you know, doing something similar.
You know, possibly. I mean, right now, there's a lot of debate going on about big tech companies and the power of big tech companies. You know, Google is not a defendant in this case, but you've seen regulators around the world look into the conduct of big tech, and like companies like Facebook and Google and Amazon. A lot of these companies for people are sort of the gateways to the internet now, right? And they control what we see. And in Facebook's case, as we know, they influence elections. And so there's a lot of questions about their power. This is sort of an example of that. Although Google isn't, as I said, a defendant in the case, this case really is about their influence over internet searches, because all of this conduct is occurring on Google, and the reason that is because Google is, for all intents and purposes, the only choice for doing internet searches, and if you and I want to search for travel, that's where we go.
Right, right, and certainly it brings open it breaks open a much larger conversation pretty quickly about how we are able to use the tools that Google makes available to us. I'm thinking in particular of France, and I think it was also Switzerland, but also possibly Germany, had this conversation with newsrooms and Google and Facebook of how content is displayed and how people get their access to information. So yeah, I think a lot of people around the world are thinking about this topic, or beginning to anyway, and it's something that comes up a lot in this program, and that is how the law is often a step behind behavior online and how it is really struggling to catch up in this time.
Right, yeah. Right. And that's a big debate going on right now, and not to get too off topic, but you know, related to this is there's this huge debate going on right now about Facebook, right? And you saw the co-founder of Facebook this week say, you know, we need to break up the company because it's too big and powerful. On the other hand, that's like that's a difficult thing to do. You know, the power of big tech, power of big companies, is a big issue. It's coming up in the election. You have a lot of candidates talking about this right now, like Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders. Even Trump's talking about the influence of big tech. You know, his complaint is about how they suppress, the companies deny this, but how they suppress conservative views. So this is definitely front and center at the moment.
Yeah, there's a lot to it. Well, I appreciate you joining us today and getting into this story with us. David McLaughlin, reporter at Bloomberg. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right, we're going to take a little break, and when we come back, we're going to take a look at some Mother's Day numbers, lots and lots of numbers around that holiday. Back in just a bit here on 720 WGN. It's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. A little bit longer show today. Instead of wrapping things up at 1 o'clock, we're going to go till 1:30 and then hand the mic over to Andy Mazur for the White Sox pregame. You definitely want to stick around for that as he gets you ready for today's game in Toronto. So, you know, before the break, we were talking with David McLaughlin, a reporter at Bloomberg, about these allegations against Expedia. And it really opened up a little bit broader conversation about tech companies and the feelings people are having around tech companies right now. And of course, he mentioned the recent piece from Chris Hughes. It was in the New York Times. It's time to break up Facebook. He's one of the co-founders, and he's essentially saying, you know what? Love you, but we got to stop now. You know, that's really the gist of it. It's a long piece. I'll tweet it out for those of you who follow me on Twitter. I'll tweet it out after the show today so you can read it for yourself. I think you should read it yourself. I think there's a lot of really interesting points in it from someone who has a very, very specific point of view and a very interesting vantage point, right? Here's someone who knew the players involved very closely early on. And, you know, it opens even with like a very sweet little scene. Like the last time I saw Mark Zuckerberg was in the summer of 2017. Talks about like hugging his wife goodbye, and they chatted briefly, and it was kind of this lovely little scene in the park. And then it really kind of goes into other things. But there's a couple of pieces in here I want to share with you, because it's as he's calling for breaking up. He's saying Facebook is too big. It's a monopoly. It owns too much stuff. It's just too much. It's time to break it up into smaller pieces. He says this that I think is a really important part of this. Mark's influence is staggering, far beyond that of anyone else in the private sector or in government. He controls three core communication platforms, Instagram and WhatsApp, that billions of people use every day. Facebook's board works more like an advisory committee than an overseer. It goes on to say, Mark alone can decide how to configure Facebook's algorithms to determine what people see in their news feeds, what privacy settings they can use, and even which messages get delivered. He sets the rules for how to distinguish violent and incendiary speech from the merely offensive, and he can choose to shut down a competitor by acquiring, blocking, or copying it. That's a pretty significant paragraph of language right there.
Hmm.
I mean, especially from a you know, from someone who was part of this early on.
Right.
I think, you know, his words carry a little more weight than if someone else were to say, hey, this is, you know, Elizabeth Warren has been saying much of the same thing. Hey, Facebook needs to get broken up. But this, from Chris Hughes, this has a different tone because he had the inside view of this and he sees it differently than most.
Yeah, he was one of the co-founders. He's profited enormously from the company and he left in 2007 or 2008, I think. I think I have that right. So it's been a while. But yeah, and I think he acknowledges directly somewhere in the piece that he feels conflicted and partially responsible. You know, yeah. some manner of guilt for what's happened in the past few years, even though it's after his tenure.
Yeah, he says, Mark is a good, kind person, but I'm angry that his focus on growth led him to sacrifice security and civility for clicks. I'm disappointed in myself and the early Facebook team for not thinking more about how the newsfeed algorithm could change our culture, influence elections, and empower nationalist leaders. And I'm worried that Mark has surrounded himself with a team that reinforces his beliefs instead of challenging him. Again, like, this is a beautifully written piece. It's really well written with really powerful language in it that is not not insignificant. Later in the piece, it says, we're a nation of with a tradition of reigning in monopolies, no matter how well-intentioned the leaders of these companies may be. Mark's power is unprecedented and un-American. It is time to break up Facebook.
There's a lot of I mean, we do have some tradition of breaking up monopolies, but
Not entirely.
When you look around, plenty of it.
I know.
When you look around today, it's kind of you feel these same tensions happening in a lot of different
so many sectors of business.
Exactly.
Yeah,
so
I thought that was interesting too.
I think he's being, you know, optimistic there and trying to inspire people's better graces or something like that.
Yeah, I think so too. He makes another point later that this is sort of a side point because I want to get back to the bigger topic, and that is Facebook as a monopoly. But he says, from our earliest days, Mark used the word domination to describe our ambitions with no hint of irony or humility. I want to go on a little side tangent about that because I've been thinking lately about how language is so geared to that. Language is geared to only being the best, not being like, I'm going to have a great day and do all my work and feel good about it. We say, I'm going to crush it. I'm going to kill it. I'm going to dominate it. I'm going to rule the world. You know, we have this thing that's built into our language right now where only the best will do. And it automatically is very competitive because if you dominate, then you're the one doing the dominating. You are the one, not, hey, my team and I are going to do a great job today. It's not like all of us. I wish everybody well today. It's like, I'm going to crush it and kill it and destroy the competition.
Right. There will be some expense for my success.
For my success. Right. It's almost this bigger subconscious message that there isn't enough success for everyone.
And you just mean in life, because in business, of course, that's inherent. Growth is,
sure.
And especially this is his problem with what Facebook became. We can pick this up after the news, but his problem with what Facebook became after he left was so only focused on growth at the cost of many other things. And I think a lot of businesses can relate to that. That's kind of the world we live in right now, is you need to be growing. You can't just be profitable. You have to be more profitable than you were last year.
Oh, it's like unheard.
That's how it works.
Unheard of to put humans before dollars. And I think that was kind of a little bit of what we saw in this story that came up a few months ago about, or maybe even more than a few months ago, about the comment moderators at Facebook and what a miserable time they have. They started talking as they were leaving the company saying, yeah, we were doing terrible things just to cope with these horrible things we were seeing and you know, all this stuff. And it was, I'll find that too and tweet it out because it's pretty,
yeah, we can come back to this too.
Horrifying is what it is. Anyway, we're going to take a break, get you the news, all the good stuff, back in just a bit here on 720 WGN. It's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. A little bit longer show than usual today. We're going to, instead of ending things at 1 o'clock, we're going to keep going till 1:30 and then turn things over to Andy Mazur for the White Sox pregame to get you ready for that White Sox game against Toronto. So before the break, or before news rather, we were talking a little bit about this op-ed in the New York Times. It's time to break up Facebook. And it's all about, you know, hey, Facebook has reached monopoly status. It's too big. It's written by Chris Hughes, who was one of the original team members there at Facebook. And for those of you who follow me on Twitter, I just tweeted that out. And the other story that I was mentioning about the investigative piece that was taking a look at moderators, Facebook comment moderators, and how they're starting to show signs of PTSD, and they're doing a lot of really turning to a lot of dangerous behavior to cope with it, because they're seeing, I mean, if you think about what makes it on Facebook, imagine what doesn't. So that right. Someone's pulling all that down. But there's another piece, there's another op-ed I want to talk about too. And it's kind of in the same vein of someone kind of calling out, a family, something they're part of. And that is, it's in the Washington Post. It was written by Abigail Disney. She is, Griffin, tell me if I have this right. She is the daughter of Walt Disney's nephew.
I believe that's right.
Okay. Sisters, brothers, doctors, friends, tennis players, friends. Yeah, that. Right. She's a Disney.
But she's got the name.
She's got the name. So we're going to say a Disney heiress, a Disney family member, has written this piece that's really, really fascinating. It's time to call it Disney and anyone else rich off their workers' backs. This piece is essentially saying, hey, Disney has a huge role right now. It's a huge company. It owns a whole lot of stuff. And it is a very emotional company that a lot of people have very sentimental feelings about it. So who better to lead the way and show and lead towards wage equality? And she's pointing to a lot of economic factors. She calls out, let me read this paragraph to you because it's really a bold one. It says, I had to speak out about the naked indecency of chief executive Robert Iger's pay. According, he took home more than $65 million in 2018. That's 1,424 times the median pay of a Disney worker. To put that gap in context, in 1978, the average CEO made about 30 times a typical worker's salary. Since 1978, CEO pay has grown by 937%, while the pay of an average worker has grown just 11.2%. That's, you know, I think the most effective op-ed pieces, and I read a lot of them. You know, a lot of times we rely on this emotional plea in an op-ed. Sometimes we just say, here are the facts, accept them or not. But this one is an intersection of the two. Here's a Disney.
Right.
Talking about a company that a lot of people feel very sentimental about. And using all this data saying, hey, here are the facts. Let's make this, let's have this conversation.
I knew that this op-ed existed. It came out a couple weeks ago, actually. And I was aware of its general point of view, but I didn't read it till today. And that initial plea saying, people love you, give them a reason to basically, that was interesting.
and bold. Look, bold.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Because I'm sure.
And you can make these complaints about many different companies. You know, CEO pay across the board is exponentially higher than average employee pay, as kind of to be expected.
Well, and that's
but
a big conversation.
You can't say to every company, you know, people have such warm feelings towards you. So just using
Disney has a special place.
Right, exactly.
It's true. Yeah, this conversation is happening in parallel in the healthcare industry because hospital CEO pay is really astronomical right now. And some of the most well-paid hospital CEOs are in Chicago. Some of them are making millions and millions of dollars when they're saying, oh, you know, yes, we'll make sure we're paying more than minimum wage. And people are like, right, but you could buy all of our houses in cash and that would be no problem, you know. So I think people are just saying, hey, this is a, the term we're seeing more and more, barbell, this barbell economy, the smaller middle class that there's a lot of people have a lot and a lot of people have a little and there's very little in between. And it is, it's a really interesting place that Disney occupies because,
right.
You know, she says, that's because the Disney brand occupies a special place in our economic landscape. Its profits are powered by emotion and sentiment. And yes, something as fundamental as the difference between right and wrong. I believe that Disney could well lead the way, if its leaders so choose, to a more decent, humane way of doing business. I mean, the other thing I think, like the elephant in the room with this, is it takes a certain amount of boldness in her shoes to call this out as a Disney. You know, to call this out. On the other hand, it's like, well, easy for you to say. You've probably benefited from your name and family in ways that, you know, easy for you to stand there and do that. You probably don't worry about how to pay the electric bill.
That's certainly true. I mean, and Disney would probably say a couple of things that, and she mentions in the piece that they gave a $1,000 bonus to, 125,000 employees in 2018?
Yeah.
A simple calculation would tell you that's $125 million that they gave back to their employees. And, far be it for me to weigh in. But that is a small her counter to that. And that's a point worth making. You know, we are experiencing new highs in profitability in a company that's seen a lot of success in the past century. And they certainly are. Like, we could talk more about the ways that Disney has so successfully diversified and how we're kind of living in their world, at least as far as entertainment goes, and might continue to be in the next couple of years. But they would say, look, we recognize the insane amount of money that we're making, and we did something to give some back. $125 million, she would say, and I kind of agree, to Disney is not much at all.
I mean, the very next sentence is, but that $125 million or so was dwarfed by the $3.6 billion with a B it spent to buy shares back to drive up its stock price and thus enrich its shareholders.
She mentions other tactics that they took in hopes of suppressing minimum wage.
Yeah.
When I was reading this, I was wondering, how many employees does Disney have and what do they do? I mean, I know that there are the parks workers, and I actually looked up people who work at, like, Walt Disney World Resorts. There's about 75,000 employees, give or take. Or that's the figure I saw.
According to this piece, in total, there's just over 200,000 employees.
In the company, total. I was just trying to think, what are their jobs? What do those salaries look like? We know the disparity,
right?
The number of times more that Bob Iger is making, but what is a sort of run-of-the-mill Disney employee taking home? And that's not an answer that I know exactly. I mean, I'm sure it varies.
Yeah. And I know there's so much, you know, every couple of years we hear these stories about, you know, somebody who didn't shave going to work and he was like in the Prince Charming suit and had to leave. You know, all these rules around it. You know, we just kind of hear these anecdotal stories about a Disney worker, you know, took their goofy head off for a second and got fired because a kid saw, you know, they really take the suspension of disbelief very, very seriously. And that's kind of part of the Disney magic. So you wonder, you know, what do you get paid to walk around Orlando dressed as Goofy in a very hot costume? I don't know.
And I always get, it trips me out the way that we speak about huge amounts of money as if they're nothing. Because of course, to me, $125 million that they spent on their employees, I mean, that's a lot of money to me.
Sure.
But I don't deal with that much kind of money.
Right.
So just to act like, oh, I'm trying to put myself in the position of Disney and act like that's not that much to me, when the change in perspective is so vast. But the truth is, you know, Dumbo, do you remember Dumbo? It came out, the live action remake of that Disney just did of Dumbo like a month ago.
I can't with like sad animals ever in movies, so I'll avoid all the... I did not see Dumbo, even though
you'd be forgiven for already having forgotten it. It was basically considered by Disney standards a failure, even though it made $330 million worldwide.
Isn't that stunning to imagine that kind of that kind of failure?
Well, that's maybe some people wouldn't categorize it that way, but generally speaking, for the kinds of returns that Disney sees these days on their properties, that was not what they were looking for.
Oh, no.
From that.
There was a really interesting infographic that I keep saying a week or two ago, but I feel like time has gone so fast the first few months of this year, so it was probably like 3 or 4 months ago already. I'll find this because I had shared it on social media at the time, but it's an infographic of now here is all the stuff that Disney owns. And it's really, it's stunning.
Well, and something we can take a break and come back and talk about this, but they just released and this is something they've done before, their release schedule for the next
basically the rest of the year, yeah?
Yeah, more like 8, 9 years, although it's more detailed for the next 2 years. And then they kind of have some projections.
I said
for
year,
the next...
I meant decade, not year.
Right, yeah, no, close to a decade. And the amount of stuff that they own, even if you have some familiarity with what they own, it's more than you think, I think. So we can touch on that in a sec.
I feel like Monopoly has been the theme of the show today.
Absolutely. And I feel like we're kind of beating up on these big companies, which I don't
like to
take.
But you know what? They don't
care. They certainly don't care. That's true. I just don't like to take one tone.
I know.
In talking about all these different cases. And this one is different in that Disney is traditionally profitable. Kind of make money the old-fashioned way. That's changing, but like compared to Uber and Lyft, who are not profitable in that way.
You know, for me, the Uber story, and then we need to go to break, but for me, the Uber story is, I can read the data just as well as anyone else, but what's interesting to me is how we continually use this phrase, it's just business, when business is, in fact, so emotional. We talk about how unemotional it is and should be, but it's so emotionally driven, and so much of the stock market is just is just emotion. And I think that's so fascinating.
In the last two stories, Facebook and these Disney people affiliated with the companies calling them out. There's a huge emotional component to that. So that's been running through the news this week.
Yeah, I think it's a really, it's an interesting time to have that conversation. Well, we're going to take a break and continue this here in a bit on 720 WGN. WGN. It's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Wrapping things up here in just a bit and handing the mic over to Andy Mazur for that White Sox pregame here at 1:30. Well, Mother's Day is tomorrow, and I hope you have done all the things that you intend to do to celebrate the day. It can be a fraught day. It can be emotional. I think I've already seen the posts popping up talking about, like, missing my mom today and people who've lost their mothers. And then people, I've seen a couple of posts talking about, you know, like struggling with infertility and things like that. And, you know, I don't mention that to belittle the day or take away from it. We should celebrate the moms in our lives for sure. But, you know, it's complicated. I think there's a lot of emotion wrapped up in that one for sure. But this is a business show. And even though we've been saying the whole show, hey, there's no emotion in business, so people say, indeed there is. And Mother's Day spending is expected to be very, very high this year. It's supposed to be, a record $25 billion this year on flowers, jewelry, greeting cards, and the like. That's according to the National Retail Federation. $25 billion with a B is a whole lot. I'm not saying my mom doesn't deserve it. I was on the phone actually earlier on my way in here. Like, they were like, we have a problem with the flower delivery for your mom. And I thought, oh, they're like, would it be okay to deliver it on Tuesday? I was like, oh no. Mm. No. If that's the problem, you need to call her and tell her that yourself, because she's not going to buy it from me.
You can maybe do a day early.
Yeah, that's why I was like, deliver maybe. It today. It's fine. Deliver
not,
it today.
But so late?
That's
what, no.
That's how we solved it. They're going to deliver it today. And I was like, oh man, if my mom got flowers on Tuesday, huh, come on.
2 days late, might as well be 2 weeks.
Oh, I might as well never call her again. She'd be like, I don't have a daughter. We're done here. She'd think I waited to the last minute, and that's what she thinks.
I've witnessed you handling some of that call, and I say you were very grace. You handled it with grace.
I was,
I'll say that.
I was very chill to have been on the phone for 27 minutes or 28 minutes before someone picked up. But indeed, so 25, I did not spend $25 billion on the flowers.
That's not all coming from
you. I, in fact, used a coupon and used a cashback card to get it. Nonetheless, so happy Mother's Day to everybody tomorrow. And it's interesting, this piece, I'll tweet this out too. It's from the LA Times. It's about why we're spending a little bit more and all of that. And it's a really interesting thing how younger shoppers, millennial shoppers, tend to go for more experiential stuff. So a little bit less on the, like, flower, jewelry, card stuff, and a little bit more on the outings and dining. And it's one of the bigger dining nights of the year. I wouldn't have guessed that. I would have said, like, Valentine's Day. Anyway, I'll tweet this out and you can read it for yourself. Right now, we're going to take a break and get you ready to go to Andy Mazur for the White Sox pregame. Back in just a bit on 720 WGN.